Dark Matter Halo Assembly Bias. This is work done in collaboration with Dick Bond and Alex Shurikov at CETA and Martin White at Berkeley. All right, so you can all hear me, right? Okay. So we observe the clustering of galaxies and quasars and things like that. Okay, but we calculate the clustering of the matter. So to relate the two, what we need is a mapping between the clustering of galaxies and quasars. Mapping of that to the clustering of the matter. And the quantity relating the two is called the bias. So the bias is a measure of the clustering amplitude for for galaxies or quasars or halos or anything really. So the simplest way to define the bias is as follows. That's a simple linear constant bias model. In which you write the overdensity of galaxies in some region or halos, as a constant times the local overdensity of matter on the same region. And the nice thing about writing things that way is that the two-point functions of the halos or galaxies or quasars or whatever, as the various endpoint functions, so they are very simply expressed, therefore, in terms of the underlying matter correlation functions. So the halo two-point function, for example, also it's just the bias squared times the matter two-point function and so on. So if we move this delta to this side of the equation, you can see that the bias corresponds physically, to a derivative of the number of objects as the background density level is varied up and down. So if you raise the background density level, by some small amount, so if the number of objects changes very dramatically, that derivative is large and the bias is large, and those objects are, they'll be clustered strongly inside of high density regions. Yeah, so you can think of the bias, as something like d log number density d log rho. Yeah, that's right.
Cool.
I'm not sure if that has any special meaning.
No. The number of objects, otherwise.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the definition of the bias. Okay, so next I'll describe where the bias comes from. And for halos, it is very easy to see the origin of the bias. So halos are thought to arise from the gravitational collapse of peaks of the initial linear density field. So the clustering of halos on large scales comes from two separate pieces. So part of the clustering of halos comes from the clustering of the initial peaks that the halos collapse from. And part of the clustering comes from the motion of those peaks over time as structure grows in the universe. So on large scales at least, the motion of peaks, in the universe, but that motion is simply just advection along large scale bulk flows. So on large scales, the part of the overdensity coming from the motion of peaks is just the matter overdensity on that scale. So the bias, we said, was the ratio of the halo overdensity divided by the matter overdensity on that scale. So you can see that the bias is just simply 1 plus the ratio of these two terms. And this ratio is called the Lagrangian bias. And this ratio measures the relative importance of the initial clustering of those initial peaks compared to the present-day matter clustering. Now, one important point to bear in mind is that in this ratio, the numerator is a constant in time, while the denominator grows like the growth factor. So over time, the bias for a population of objects that isn't changing, the bias decays over time towards zero, like one over the growth factor. So that's the Lagrangian bias. The total bias is of course 1 plus that. So the total bias for a population of objects that isn't changing, that total bias decays towards 1, like one of the growth factor. And that point will be important later on. So that was the time dependence of bias. Now I'll describe the mass dependence of bias. And the simplest way to see the mass dependence of bias, just is to go through a simple worked example. So the simplest example to go through is the pressure vector model. So the key assumption in the model is that halos form locally in regions, okay, wherever the local overdensity exceeds a critical threshold for collapse called delta C, okay, the linear overdensity that is, okay, and delta C is determined, from the spherical collapse model, okay. So the bias we said, corresponds to a derivative of the number of objects as you raise or lower the background density level, okay, And so raising the background density level, clearly corresponds to lowering the local threshold by the corresponding amount, okay. So we can very easily compute the Prescheter bias, okay, just by taking the derivative, of the mass function, with respect to the threshold for collapse delta C, okay. So delta C appears in two places in the mass function, and so the Prescheter bias has two terms in it, okay. And these two terms illustrate the asymptotic behavior of the bias in the two limiting regimes of high masses and low masses. Okay, so the high mass regime corresponds to sigma being a very small number compared to one. Okay, so in that regime, this first term dominates the bias. Okay, it's a large positive number and it's steeply increasing with mass. Okay, which makes sense, of course, for objects far out in the tail of the mass function. All right. In contrast, the low mass regime corresponds to sigma being a small number compared to delta, a large number compared to delta C. Okay, so in that regime, this first term is very small, and the total bias is dominated by the second term. Okay, so in the low mass regime, so the bias is a slowly varying function of mass and is negative generically. All right, and physically, of course, that makes sense, okay, because raising the background density level, locally, lowers the number of small halos by making them into higher mass halos, okay. So we expect generically halos to be anti-biased at low masses. And that'll also be important later on. Okay, so that was the mass dependence of bias, okay. And besides the mass dependence, okay, recently simulations have shown, that the bias also, the bias also depends upon parameters besides just the mass. Okay, so one example is shown here. So this is showing the dependence of bias on halo concentration. This is a paper by Wexler et al. From 2006. So in this figure, the authors have divided out the very strong mean dependence of bias with mass, in order to bring out the more subtle dependence of bias on concentration, okay? And you can see that the bias depends strongly on concentration in two regimes, at very high masses and at very low masses, okay? So I'll be describing these two sort of separately. I won't be, because this is a small-scale structure conference, right? Okay, sorry, right, so I forgot that I took that out. Okay, so the one-sentence summary, the high mass behavior is as follows. Okay, so massive halos, sitting inside of high density regions. Okay, the mass supply is higher for them. Okay, and so they grow more quickly than similar halos living in low density regions. Okay, that's the full effect. Okay, and quantitatively it matches with so that matches the bias that you see in simulations, okay? Just that simple sentence. Using similar arguments, you can also explain the mass function of high mass halos at the high mass end analytically, the accretion rates onto the high mass halos, the total bias, all these properties follow, very, very simply for the high mass halos. It's sort of neat. Okay, but again, though, this conference is on small things and so on and so forth. Sorry, you can't hear about this. Okay, so low mass assembly bias. So this is a plot of the assembly bias at low masses. This is from Gao's paper in 2005. So this is plotting the spatial distribution of halos taken in a narrow mass spin from the Millennium simulation. So left panel shows the young halos, right panel is the old halos. Okay. And you can see the spatial clustering of the old halos, stronger here than it is here. Just visually you can see that. Okay, so that's the effect we're trying to explain. Okay, so why is that happening? What was the line of that figure, Gao? On the side, you mean, or line of sight?
Left side.
Okay. Okay, so you just pancake the box. Oh, so it was a slice, it wasn't a pancake. I guess that makes sense because these filaments are like very, very prominent. I mean, yeah, it was a whole monster problem so much. All right. Okay, so why is this happening? So first let me show you the average mass accretion histories for low mass halos. Okay. So here I'm plotting the average stacked mass accretion histories for halos taken in a narrow mass bin at z equals zero. And I split them into bins of age, basically, you know, basically formation time. Okay. And the important point that I want you to note is that for the oldest halos of this narrow mass bin, okay, you know, for the oldest halos, okay, like, you know, the amount of growth, you know, at late times has been, you know, basically zero. Okay, you know, they haven't changed much for a long amount of time. So therefore, we expect those halos, they can become unbiased, you know, over time. And indeed, simulations show that behavior. Okay. So the oldest low mass halos become unbiased, okay? In contrast, the rest of the low mass halos become anti-biased at levels, you know, at levels that you would expect naively, okay? You know, so naively, you would expect the bias for low mass halos to asymptote towards, you know, like, you know, B goes towards 1 minus 1 over delta C at low masses. Delta C is around 1.6, okay? So asymptotically, this approaches around sort of 0.4 as sigma goes to infinity, right? And indeed, what you see just is that, okay? So the amount of assembly bias that you see, like, you know, for low masses is not at all surprising, okay? These are all isolated objects, that's right. Okay, yes. Oh, yeah, I should also mention, so other work also finds the same results. So Gao and White, analyzing the Lenning simulation, you know, they also found that low masses, the oldest low mass halos are unbiased. The young halos are anti-biased at levels, you know, that you would expect naively.
So these are different top redshifts and where is the formation time?
Okay, so
formation redshift.
Okay, so they've split the halo samples into the oldest, like it's 20-something percent, and the youngest 20-something percent, as a function of, well, basically mass. Okay, and at low masses, you can see that. I think it's all right. Which were mostly unbiased people's size, and strong anti-bias the youngest ages. Okay. Right, okay. So next question is now, what's the mechanism turning off the growth in the old halos? Okay. So most small halos that, like, you know, simulations, okay, most ones that you find, okay, you know, they mostly tend to sit inside of small filaments, okay. However, it was found, like, you know, it was found, however, like, you know, by Wong et al. And also us, and also Simon White's group, okay, that the oldest halos, okay, like, you know, so the oldest low mass halos, so they tend to be found inside of, like, you know, they're found close to, like, you know, more massive objects, more massive halos. Okay, you know, in contrast to most of the other halos of the same mass. Okay, so the fact that they're found nearby more massive objects, okay, you know, okay, you know, that implies, you know, well, that implies, you know, that a local effect of the massive halos, you know, might be, like, you know, might be turning off the growth in the small halos. Okay. And indeed, simulations also show this. Okay. So if you plot the local ambient velocity dispersion, around the small halos, okay, as a function of age, what you find is that, you know, for most of the small halos, okay, you know, the local ambient velocity dispersion, okay, you know, typically, okay, you know, typically smaller than the escape velocity from the small halo, okay, you know. Yeah, so it's not surprising, therefore, you know, that these small halos can grow. However, in contrast, the local ambient velocity dispersion around the most, the oldest low mass halos, also typically exceeds greatly the local escape velocity from the small halo. Okay, you know,
So it's not surprising, therefore, okay, so it's not surprising, that these halos stop growing, okay? It's very straightforward. So tidal effects actually aren't important, it seems. I'll just mention that.
Between tidal effect and this other thing, they stop.
That's your local temperature, okay? The tidal radii of the small halos are operating, do not seem to differ very sharply as a function of age.
Temperature.
It's the temperature of the local material, available to be created. And it's too hot for them to be.
Do you think that it's moving too fast?
They're moving too fast relative to the ambient stuff.
But this is just temperature in the kinetic sense. It's not. This is all dark.
This is all dark matter. That's right. Right.
So this makes Jim's problem that much worse.
Yeah, so I kind of missed this talk, so I'll take your word on that. Yeah, okay, right. But the tidal radii, however, they don't seem different at all. Okay. In contrast to some things in the literature. Right. Okay, so the survival of the small halos is also it's also interesting, but maybe it's slightly off topic, so maybe I'll
Okay. Well, I should let you say what you're going to say, but are you going to say that if you go and identify things by mass in rich environments, in fact, those things have already been through more massive halos and got flung out?
I wasn't going to say that, but however, it is true. It is true that most of these old low mass halos that we're finding in our simulations, most of them seem to have been subhalos in the past. Now, if that means that they've been slingshot out or just sort of flew through, we can't say.
So the halos are defined in my friends and friends.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So that's, does that not raise problems then with the fresh Schechter interpretation of all this?
Yes, well, in a sense, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So spherical top hat, is not completely correct, especially as especially at low masses.
I mean, I'm just thinking, ideally you'd like to say, okay, their growth is stunted because you figure out how much mass is around them and how fast they grow in a fresh Schechter sense in that very sort of environment.
Fresh Schechter, of course, doesn't incorporate this at all, that's right.
You're saying something quite different, which is maybe that they did agree on mass, but it got stripped off.
But how massive?
But it has something to do with what mass you associate with fresh Schechter mass. Because if it's really just subhalos getting flung out and all that kind of stuff, that should be part of the virialized region. It shouldn't be separated. Qualitatively, It's not
if they stay bound to the halo, right?
If they stay bound,
So these papers by
so aside from the fraction that gets unbound, so sure, some fraction gets unbound. Yeah.
That's the question.
Did it get unbound, or it was just never bound, and it was just considered?
So we can't actually answer that. Yeah, we don't know.
But even ones that are not. That are still bound can still go beyond the VO radius.
That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying you physically misidentified the radius that should be the fresh Schechter radius.
That's a possibility. That's right. Yeah, right. And I guess that you're mentioning this in this talk. Paper was arguing that the sort of bound mass is sort of more appropriate for fresh Schechter. I'm not sure if I believe that, but. Go on.
I mean, there is also, galaxy wise, people do talk about zero velocity surfaces. I don't know what would happen if you went through and identified things that way.
So my problem with that Cuesta stuff is the following, right? So what they do is to plot the.
There's a big record.
So let me turn this off real quick. So what they do is to plot the the average radial velocity. In shells as a function of radius, So for massive objects like clusters, the radius profile is like zero at small radius, the realized region is infall, and then it tracks onto the Hubble expansion. And so their point was that so for low masses, the behavior is like this instead, right? And it's not obvious that this mass is bound to the small object, right? So defining mass this way. Isn't obviously physical, I think. I guess that wasn't a very deep point. What's that?
Whose point is this?
Cuesta.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this was at Questa clipping paper. Yeah. It's very interesting, I mean, like, what they showed, but I mean, yeah, you know.
It's certainly not measurable, I guess.
But it is measurable if it's bound, right? I mean,
but there are two things.
Not in reality, not in simulation, yes. But.
There's a difference?
Okay. But there are two things, though, right? That plot that you drew is also mass dependent, right?
Oh, well, yeah, well, that was my point, yeah.
Sorry. Oh, okay, yeah. So, I mean, part of this is just the effect you've already
exactly.
pointed out, isn't it? No.
Okay. All right, so good. Okay, so then...
I mean, you can imagine selecting isolated small galaxies that probably would work.
No, it doesn't work, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's right.
But I imagine that I figured the heating was just sort of the other stuff falling onto the other stuff, making the ambient... like the filaments and stuff, making those look.
Yeah, okay, right. Okay, so now I'm not sure if I selected only, like, you know, only the youngest.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, okay. That's easy to check, yeah. Right. But the average radial velocity is, into these small mass halos, generally is small. Yeah, so I'm not sure if that's due to the different cancellations in outflow. Like objects that are being stripped, like input out, like you know, growing objects, or it's just that they're all being stripped. But it's easily sort of check, yeah. Okay, so I'll just take this. Okay, right. So this is basically just again, summarizing what I said before. So I'll skip that. This is summarizing it again. So I'll skip that. Okay. So the final like for a fourth summary. Okay. Right, okay, so at high masses, assembly bias at high masses, it's very, very simple, okay? So it follows just from the spherical collapse model combined with statistics of Gaussian peaks. And that's it. You know, fully explains the mass function, assembly bias, everything. At low masses, the behavior is somewhat different. So at low masses, the effect is mostly driven by the formation of a subpopulation of objects that have stopped growing, okay? The mechanism turning off the growth appears to be the hot environments they live in. Okay? Because they stop growing, they naturally become unbiased, making them more clustered than the anti-biased growing peers of the same mass. And that's the full effect. Okay, so I'll stop there.